every department of human thought, nay, even of human action. He has revolutionized not biology alone, but all science, not science alone, but all philosophy, not philosophy alone, but all human life. Man, his origin and nature, his future hopes and realizable ideals, all seem something different to this present generation. And Senator Obama is being inaugurated even as we speak. Anyway, Darwin reconsidered. I hand over to Peter Collins.
Thank you, Robert. As you all know, 2009 is the 200th anniversary of Darwin's birth in February and the 150th anniversary of the publication of On the Origin of Species in November. And that is the inspiration for this series through this term and these many other events that we've just been described. One of the exciting things about Darwin's studies is the very wide range of topics and themes which it touches on. And as you will see from the programme, during this term we will be addressing many different disciplines of interest within the university and beyond. When we started organising this programme, we had in mind a very neat division between a few lectures on Darwin in his own time, so to speak, Darwin in the 19th century, and another group of lectures on Darwinism today. As we developed the programme and contacted the speakers and checked out diaries and so on, that very neat division collapsed completely. And so the programme that you see doesn't have, going through the term, that neat sequence that we had in mind. But it does have reference to the very large number of disciplines to which Darwinism is relevant. History, theology, philosophy, anthropology, and so on, and so on. And so, not to mention biology. And so Darwinism does touch these many areas. Just before I introduce our speaker, a couple of practical things. Because this room is the dining room for the college, we have to leave promptly at 6 o'clock. So we will have to curtail the discussion a little bit in here, but if some of you wish to continue the discussion with the speaker, please come just across the corridor to the senior common room and the discussion can be continued in there. Not with everybody, I hasten to say, it's not big enough, but if you're really desperate to talk to the speaker, please do that. As you leave afterwards, there will be copies of the complete programme of the term. Please take one of those with you. And if you would like more details of activities from the centre, there will be a list for you to sign with an email address. Now, our speaker today is Professor Steve Fuller, who is Professor of Sociology at the University of Warwick. He is a graduate of Columbia and Cambridge. He has a PhD in the History and Philosophy of Science from the University of Pittsburgh and a DLit from the University of Warwick. He's well known for work in what he describes as social epistemology, which addresses the social and sociological input to organised knowledge. He served as an expert witness for the defence in the recent case in the United States affecting the Dover School Board and the teaching of intelligent design. He is the author of 15 books, most recently The Knowledge Book, Key Concepts in Philosophy, Science and Culture, 2007, New Frontiers in Science and Technology Studies, also 2007, Science versus Religion, question mark, also 2007, that was a good year for writing, and most recently, Dissent Over Descent, Intelligent Design's Challenge to Darwinism, 2008. Today, Professor Fuller will be speaking on Darwin's original sin, the rejection of theology's claim of knowledge.
That's for that. Thank you.
Thank you, and I want to thank Peter Collier for inviting me, and thank all of you for showing up to the talk today. What I want to do here is basically to make an argument for why theology is very relevant as a form of knowledge in terms of assessing scientific claims and more generally, normative claims about where we are in the world today. This is not to say that one cannot disagree with theological claims, but nevertheless, theology should be regarded as a discipline with some cognitive content. And I think that's a very important point to underscore today, because when people allow faculties of theology to exist, it's quite common to think of them in terms of providing pastoral counseling only, right? In other words, a kind of version of psychiatry. Okay, and what I want to argue here is that, in fact, there is cognitive content to theology, that there is something that it is about, and increasingly, other disciplines have retreated from the kind of domain that theology is about. Okay, so that's kind of where I want to go with this talk today. And to, as was already mentioned in the introduction, I've in the last couple of years have written two books that try to relate science and religion. And I have to say that from my own standpoint, the religions that are really operative here are the monotheistic religions from Abraham. Okay, these are the ones that I think are in a way, the most interesting and the most controversial and also the most related to the developments in modern philosophy and science. Okay, and I say this at the outset not because I'm trying to be sectarian in some sort of way, but I think very often when one sees that a person who knows something about sociology is involved in these kinds of discussions, that at the end, that such a person is a relativist. Right. In other words, part of what's being defended, let's say, to allow intelligent design to be taught, is just the idea that, you know, people have many different worldviews, many different standpoints, and so forth, and that one needs to be kind of free and open-minded about things. No, there's a more substantial claim being made here. Right. It's not a claim that I would so easily make about Hinduism, Buddhism, other sorts of religions. It has a lot to do with the historical rootedness of modern science and philosophy in the Abrahamic religions, which has to do with the privileged place of human beings in nature. And that's a very important point. I will be coming back to that, because I think one of the things that is very much under challenge in our time, and Darwin in a way stands as a symbol for this, is the privilege of human beings as a species. I think this is the thing to play for, as it were, in terms of the reintroduction of theology. Okay, because if we're just talking about a kind of general sacred, you know, attitude toward nature, we really don't need the Abrahamic religions for that. That is actually quite common across religions all over the world. But that sort of view would not necessarily have led people to do science in the way that we understand it in the modern period, which has to do with the idea of penetrating into the nature of reality, trying to understand it at some level of depth so that we actually can predict and control quite a lot of it, and increasingly more as the years go by, even though we have had a lot of negative consequences as a result of pursuing that activity. Okay? And notice that I've now made a very positive statement, plus acknowledging that there has been a kind of backwash, right? A negative aspect to our having pursued science the way we have. And it's for that reason that in a lot of my more recent writing, and some of you who follow the blog Uncommon Dissent, which is William Dembski's blog concerning intelligent design, know that I have been, since the beginning of the year, talking a lot about theodicy. Right, which is a very specific branch of theology that really gets coined in the beginning of the 18th century by Leibniz, but in a way has always been very much part of the Abrahamic traditions in theology, and that is the idea of divine justice. Why is the world the way it is? So in other words, you start with the assumption that not everything is perfect, at least to the naked eye, that there are problems, there are flaws, there is death, there is extinction. There is suboptimality all over the place. That is granted. And then the question is, what's the point of that? Right? What is the point of that, and what should we do about it? And that's what theodicy was devoted to as a field, which in a way had its heyday from the late 17th century. It started to go into decline, starting with Kant, and of course, in a way, pretty much got killed with Darwin. Okay, so this sort of field of theodicy, in a way, is very much directly focused on the idea that, okay, we accept the idea that there is a divine creator. It is a creator in whose image and likeness we've been created, so that we can understand very deeply the nature of this creation. And yet we see all the problems that we see. Right? And as time goes on, we see the extinction, we see the death, we see the imperfections. What do we make of that? Okay, is there some meaning there that we can derive from that, from which we may go forward? And that is the problem that theodicy put forward. And it seems to me this is the kind of thing that, in a way, the Darwinian revolution has just taken off the table, but nevertheless is very relevant for us to bring back today. Okay, because at stake is what is the point of us as human beings in this kind of situation? Okay, so that's kind of where I'm coming from. And in principle, this kind of question could be asked in secular terms. And I do think that in the course of the 19th and 20th centuries, there were certain kinds of political movements that were trying to answer this question. In the sense, you know, what would it be like for human beings to actually take control and set up a kind of just world that everybody would recognize as just? And we ended up getting the sorts of results that are associated, I think, with socialism, which are, again, both positive and negative. But I think, generally speaking, what's happened is there's been a recoil from in the secular world. There has been a tendency to say, well, the failure of socialism indicates that it is impossible for us to, in some way, come up with some normatively adequate picture of how we relate to the earth, how we relate to each other. And that, in a sense, there is no point, there is no purpose. Right? Because secular people don't have anything else other than what human beings currently have as their capacity. There is no sense of some sort of transcendent understanding, some sort of transcendent knowledge that we might be trying to get toward by doing science that would enable us to come up with a more perfect, more just world. Okay, so it seems to me that this is kind of where we are at the moment, that without something like theodicy, the idea of justice in any kind of global sense goes out the window. Okay, and this is why I should say at the outset, for those of you who've studied theology and sort of see the problem of theodicy very narrowly focused as, you know, how do you justify evil in the world? That is too restricted. That is much too restricted, and it doesn't really do justice to the issues that were being raised in the early modern era by people like Leibniz, by Nicole Malebranche, and others. And I would also include, by the way, William Paley, and also, you know, in many respects, you might say his evil twin, Joseph Priestley. Okay, Joseph Priestley is kind of a hero of mine. I might say something about that a little later. But it seems to me that this whole idea that there is a kind of divine justice that's worked out through nature, which implies that one has to rationalize in some way the imperfections of nature in order to reach a higher state, that is part of what's going on here. Okay, my own involvement with the intelligent design movement actually came from this Dover trial that was mentioned earlier on. So there's been just one case that's been brought to a high court, which basically involved a school district that wanted to teach intelligent design. And this is the idea that, right, if you want to understand the way in which nature operates, it is inadequate just to postulate some combination of chance and necessity operating over millions and millions of years, that there's another sort of standpoint, namely that there's actually intelligence involved. Okay, an intelligence in a way that is tractable to science. And this was the standpoint that the people in this Dover school district wanted to introduce to teach science students at the high school level in America. And this got defeated. My role in this was not as an expert in intelligent design theory, but rather as an expert rebutting the claims that were being made on the other side. And the other side basically had this narrative of how it was that science has reached the position that it is at today. How has science made progress? And the argument that was made was that science has made progress through the advance of something called methodological naturalism. And some of you who follow this kind of discussion will know this phrase. This is a chimera, right? This is a complete intellectual mirage, methodological naturalism. What it attempts to do is to conflate two things. And this was the point that I tried to make in the trial. On the one hand, there is this thing called the scientific method, which I don't think anyone really wants to deny or say anything against, which involves testing claims against the evidence, right, and then responding responsibly toward it. But that sort of method, which was introduced by Francis Bacon in the 17th century and to which all scientists claim allegiance to, is metaphysically neutral. That is to say, you are open, in principle, to causes of all kinds, explanations of all kinds. And what matters is what you do as a result of that. So you can hypothesize anything you want, but then how do you test it? How do you check it? How do you validate it? That's when the science comes in. Okay, and this is not just something I invented. You have this in Francis Bacon, you have this in Karl Popper. Okay, now naturalism is normally understood as a metaphysical doctrine about the way the world works. It's a monistic doctrine. It says that, you know, everything that happens in nature is of nature. End of story. That's a metaphysical notion. That is a notion that you can hold without being scientific. Okay. In fact, if you look at people like Epicurus in the ancient world, right, the ancient skeptics, the ancient hedonists, these people, right, you have actually quite a tradition of people who actually believe that the world is constituted by material forces, chance, necessity, whatever, right, and that there's nothing beyond that. It is, you know, what you see is what you get with regard to reality. But those people were not driven to do science. Their metaphysics may fit better with a certain kind of Darwinian scientific standpoint that we have now, but that doesn't mean that holding that metaphysical standpoint would have led you to do science. And I think that's a very important point here, because if we are talking about what motivates students in schools to do science, how are you going to motivate them? Right? You have to start from scratch. You have to say, well, how should you think about the world to actually think it's worth your while to engage in the testing and the experimentation and the drudgery and all the rest of it that it takes to do science? If you start at the outset by saying, well, you know, the world's this place where there's like a lot of random processes that over the course of millions of years somehow managed to get the way they are now, and who knows, maybe in a few more millions of years we'll just disappear. That's not a great motivation for doing science in the sense that has led us to people like Newton and Einstein. Okay? It is rather thinking that there is some sort of intelligible design to nature, which we are in a specific position to understand. Right? So it's not just there for any old creature to understand, but it's there for us to understand. And that by following our own, you know, by trying to expand our intellects, trying to do the hard work that it takes, realizing that in fact, you know, we are not at the level of God, but we are made in the image and likeness, that we are able to push forward and not to be easily deterred. Because this is the interesting thing, just how much in other cultures, which do not privilege the human being, right, in the center, right, how easy it has been to deter people from doing science. So we know from Hindu culture, we know from the Chinese culture, that they have had so many things that have been, as it were, necessary ingredients for doing science. And that to a large extent, the West have appropriated them, you know, and Islam appropriated them as well. I want to include Islam in my argument here, that in a sense, they are one of the Abrahamic religions as well, and that they too appropriated it. But in India, in China, you did not get modern science. You did not get the scientific revolution. You did not get that breakthrough because at the end of the day, there wasn't that metaphysical belief in the centrality of human beings as being able to understand in a very deep way the nature of the universe. Even though the mathematics was there, technology was there, all these things, but there was no motivation to put it all together into one package to understand that there's a design there. So there is a, And this had nothing to do with methodological naturalism, okay? The scientific revolution had nothing to do with methodological naturalism as it is understood today. It rather had to do with people who were, as sometimes gets said, God intoxicated, as it were, right? People who really strongly, deeply believed in God and that they believed in the Bible, that they were created in the image and likeness of God, translating that belief into methodological terms that enabled them to test their beliefs. That is what the scientific revolution is about. And so if you read, the recent... person who's been appointed to the Andreos Chair in Science and Religion here at this university, Peter Harrison, right, The Bible, Protestantism, and the Rise of Natural Science, this book of his from Cambridge University Press, maybe 10 years ago now, right, what we have here, he's making a very important point, which I think is very relevant, namely that there's a sense in which these people who we associate with the scientific revolution, one of the reasons why they were so nonconformist and dissenting as religious believers was because they read the Bible directly themselves, and they took themselves as, when it says that, you are created, that man is created in the image and likeness of God, they took that as a personal address. They took that as address to them. Right? Not address to the Pope or the priest or anything like that. It's just to say, okay, and so now we're going to try to figure out what this is. Right, what is this world for? We have the power to do that potentially. And so then over the course of the 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th centuries, you have various scientists with very strong religious beliefs trying to figure out what exactly does that mean. And that's a very profound, important point which you don't see happening in the other religions. Okay. Now, to be sure, this leads to a lot of very controversial consequences. With regard to claims about knowledge, claims about ethics, and so forth. But nevertheless, the key thing that sort of, as it were, is the red thread that runs through all this is the idea that human beings are created in the image and likeness of God and therefore can understand, make sense of nature, and in a sense have a certain kind of responsibility for what happens afterwards. And the responsibility for what happens afterwards, that is especially a controversial issue. And I'll be saying something about that in a few moments, because there is the issue of whether nature should be regarded as something that needs to be kept in itself, that has a kind of integrity of its own, or is nature to be understood, as it were, for the disposition of human beings. And I think that's a very important kind of debate that needs to be had, but it only makes sense once you grant that in some sense we can get a very comprehensive understanding of how the natural world works. And that is science. And so the question is, how do you motivate people to be engaged in that? Okay? Because it's quite, any of you who've ever taken a science course, and were not committed to being natural scientists, it's very easy to be discouraged. Right? You do an experiment, it doesn't work. Right? You come up with some sort of idea, you test it, it doesn't work. And in fact, if you look at the history of human cultures, it's been very much like that, where in a sense people get very easily discouraged, you might say. Right? Because things do not work out immediately. Things do not turn out to be true immediately. And then the question becomes, well, why do you continue? Why do you continue to put forward all these strange hypotheses, right, that are counterintuitive, that go against the grain? Why do you bother testing these things? Well, because you believe that in some sense that you have been created so that in principle you could figure this out. It may not happen today, it may not happen next week, it may in fact take several generations, but it will happen. And that's one of the things that's quite interesting about the history of science, right? History of science, it is a transgenerational project, right? Where people feel that they are part of the same project over many centuries, even though the actual beliefs, the actual views that are being put forward radically change over time. Okay? Obviously, if you're engaged in that kind of project, you're thinking about something that goes beyond just your immediate lifetime. Right? That is really striking, that we just do not reproduce the same form of knowledge with each generation. That's the kind of thing we associate with so-called primitive tribes, with animals. Right? But rather, we believe that there is a common project, that we are going somewhere, that we are learning something more. And we are quite we believe that even though along the way we get rid of a lot of what people had previously believed. Now, why do we do that? Why do we tell the history of science that way? Right? That involves an enormous amount of faith in human intellect. But where does that come from? It does not necessarily come from the track record alone. Okay? I mean, I think that's a very important point here. People start believing in the power of science before there's much on the ground to believe in terms of results. Okay? And so where are they getting this belief from? They're getting it from how they think about themselves. All right? I mean, the scientific revolution happens in the 17th century. The Industrial Revolution, if you want to say that, see that as some kind of payoff of science, happens a century later. So why do the people in the 17th century believe what they believe? It's not because of the results. It's because of a certain kind of understanding of themselves. And then the question becomes, where do they get that from? And this is where the biblical entitlement thing does matter a lot. You have to see yourself as a certain kind of person, right? A person who's been created in the image and likeness of God, who can tolerate error, who can tolerate mistakes, who believes that there's some larger thing out there, and then move forward on the basis of it. Because without that, you don't have science. And you don't have science today, either, right? Because most people who engage in science, if you look at what exactly they actually contribute to the overall body of knowledge, it is minuscule. And what they're working on for most of their working lives is trivial, regarded in its own terms. At best, it is just the deployment of a certain kind of technical expertise. Yet, nevertheless, these very smart people will devote their whole lives to it. Why? Because they believe there is this larger thing that they're getting at. Okay? I mean, so what I'm saying here is that the whole motivation for doing science, where one talks about scientific progress, right, and really believes in the idea that we're actually getting a better and better understanding of the world, okay, involves our having certain kind of confidence in ourselves, not only as individuals, but as member of a certain kind of species, and how you define that species is going to have to go way beyond what is naturalistically defined. You really have to think we're special. Okay? There's a lot of faith and a lot of trust that goes on there. And the question becomes, where do you get that from? Okay? And if you were completely, right, if you completely had, you know, tossed away your Bibles, had nothing to do with the Abrahamic religions at all, where would you get that faith? Where would you get that faith? Because most naturalistic accounts of how the mind develops, including the human mind, is, you might say, a bottom-up approach. Namely, you start with lower organisms and you basically say their brains become more complex, and that in some sense, what we call the intellect is a sort of extended version of what can be understood in terms of animal sensation. Okay. Now, the traditional argument against that, which was one of the things that got flagged very much during the period when this field of theology called theodicy was discussed in the 17th and 18th century, was the fact that we seem to have what philosophers call a priori knowledge. Knowledge that cannot be explained purely in terms of our sensory encounters with the world, or in terms of the capacities that are involved in our sensory encounters of the world. And what I'm talking about here is mathematics. We've got John Lennox here in the audience. And mathematics has typically been the sort of archetypal case of a sort of knowledge, given the expansiveness of it, given the fact that it involves our ability to understand the principles that govern numbers and forms that extend way beyond anything that we could ever sensorily encounter. Right? Because we know a lot more numbers and the laws governing them than we're ever going to be able to count. Where does that knowledge come from? Right? This was the argument that a lot of the theodicists in the 17th and 18th century thought were grounds for thinking that yes, we're animals, but there's some other kind of knowledge there too. And it's the kind of knowledge that enables us to have a sort of, potentially, an understanding of how the entire universe works. Because the entire universe, if you want to understand that, involves being able to project mathematically space and time for long periods in time into the future, into the past, none of which we will have encountered in sensory terms. and none of which could even be described in terms of the accumulated experience of particular people. Okay, so where does that knowledge come from? What is that knowledge about? Okay, and this is why mathematics has always been a very interesting kind of case, because if you take a purely naturalistic Darwinian standpoint, there is no reason why we should have the kind of higher mathematics that we do that actually anticipates, doesn't reflect our understanding of nature, but anticipates our understanding of nature. And so you think about, for example, the development of non-Euclidean geometries in the 19th century, right, several decades before Einstein. Where does that come from? Why would people think of such a thing? It turns out to have applicability later on, but nevertheless we're able to anticipate this. So this business about the anticipation of nature, that we don't just reflect nature, we don't just respond to nature, we don't just adapt to nature, but we are proactive. We have ideas that turn out to capture nature before we actually discover the terms under which they are captured. They're not pure fantasies. Okay? This was the kind of thing, if you look at somebody like Leibniz, for example, in the late 17th and early 18th century, right? This is the kind of thing that really leads him to think that there is something quite distinctive about human beings, that the biblical entitlement is in fact correct, and that you can pinpoint what it is. It is this special kind of knowledge that cannot be explained purely as the extension of animal knowledge. And to this day, let me tell you, naturalists do not have an easy time explaining mathematical knowledge. I mean, they can explain counting, right? They can explain the forms of mathematical knowledge that, in fact, are required for dealing with everyday life. But they cannot explain irrational numbers. They can't explain, you know, transcendental numbers. They can't explain non-Euclidean geometry. Why these things should suddenly come up, right? There is a kind of qualitative difference that remains unexplained here, okay? And that qualitative difference, which our modern mathematical knowledge relies on, has been incredibly instrumental in making sense of the natural world over the last three centuries. Okay? I mean, sometimes you hear from people like Richard Dawkins and other of these naturalistic Darwinist type people that, science is something that helps us adapt to the world better. It's an extended phenotype, right? That in a sense, you know, we understand our environment better so we can, as it were, restructure the environment so that more of us can survive longer. Okay? Yes, that's part of it. But that doesn't explain everything we know, and it certainly doesn't explain the fact that much of what we know, and especially what we value as knowledge, pertains to things that have no obvious direct impact on us as creatures understood under Darwinian evolution. We are concerned about the cosmos. We are concerned, and our science is framed around that idea. Okay? So in this respect, as you may know, some of you who think about the various arguments that get used for the existence of God coming from the scientific end, of course there is this anthropic principle that operates in cosmology. Well, I wish the anthropic principle would operate in biology. Okay, I mean, because one of the things that's very interesting about the anthropic principle in cosmology is that it really focuses quite specifically on the fact that we would not be able to understand how the universe works, right, if we weren't there. But what is it about us that matters? It is not everything about our animal nature. It is not us in all of our form, but the aspect of us that enables us to connect with this larger cosmos, right? This is the intelligent part of intelligent design. Okay? And I make this point here because those of you who follow a lot of the debates on intelligent design will realize that as a result of the trial in Dover, which of course the intelligent design people lost, there has been a tendency to recoil from the word intelligent and to say, look, what we're just concerned about here is the detection of design, and that Darwinists didn't deny that there's design. They think it's just chance processes, but design is real. But we're not going to make any hypotheses about intelligence. No, sorry, that's not enough. Actually, if intelligent design has any kind of meaning and is going to set up any kind of challenge to Darwinism, it has got to push the intelligence part. And that's why I'm talking about mathematics, and that's why I'm talking about the things that I'm talking about, because it is that aspect that really matters. The intelligent aspect, the thing that, in a way, fascinated all these philosophers and theologians who were involved in theodicy, right? That there was a specific kind of knowledge that only human beings seem to have. Okay? And that one needs to, in some way, account for it. It is efficacious, but it is not primarily grounded in sensory experience. It is not primarily grounded in your animal existence. It is a knowledge that you have, but it extends outward from where you are, to worlds that you have not yet experienced, but nevertheless turn out to be efficacious. Okay? And that's what philosophers call a priori knowledge, and that is, most of mathematics can be understood this way. And so there is an issue here. There is the issue of intelligence in intelligent design. And in a sense, we need to bring that back to the table with regard to biology, that there should be kind of an anthropic principle, as it were, applied to biology. Because at the moment, the kinds of explanations that Darwinists offer for why we are where we are completely impoverished in terms of understanding the aspects of our species that we normally think really distinguish us from other animals. Okay? I mean, and so there's a real kind of challenge to be put there. I'll only go on for a few more minutes because I want to open this up to questions, and to be perfectly honest, I'm not sure how you people regard this stuff that I'm saying. But let me say one thing. If you go down the route of theodicy that I'm talking about here, where somehow you have to, because I think here are the challenges, right? Theodicy is an issue of what is the nature of God's design given the acknowledgement of radical imperfection in nature. And this is what we call evil, okay, nowadays. There's a lot of challenges with this kind of discipline. The first challenge is it presupposes we can indeed get into the mind of God to a certain extent. And the argument for that is that we have been created in the image and likeness of God, and so therefore, it's at least prima facie plausible that we, on certain sorts of matters, we should be able to imagine what God had in mind, and that by doing that, we might actually be able to do something better. I think all of that is part of the background assumption of this discipline, which, of course, in certain religious circles, was very controversial. So, I recently read this book by Stephen Nadler, who's the head of the philosophy department at the University of Wisconsin, called The Best of All Possible Worlds. Because when people want to ridicule theodicy, they basically use that expression, which comes from Voltaire's Candide. And the best of all possible worlds, the reason why this is a ridiculous expression is because you can make theodicies basically justify anything, right? No matter how bad the universe is, no matter how many creatures die, no matter how awful everything is, right? There's some rational reason that we just need to figure out. Well, at a certain level, I actually think that's true. Okay? And I think it's unfortunate that it's been ridiculed. But the interesting thing about Stephen Nadler's book, which basically traces the whole history of the theodicy debates, is that how from day one there were Christians, Catholics in particular, who just thought the whole idea of raising this issue is blasphemous. Right? Because there's a sense in which no matter how you interpret the idea that we're created in the image and likeness of God, right, you cannot have that entail that we, in some sense, can second guess what God is trying to do. So Antoine Arnauld, one of the great French Catholic theologians of the 17th century, a follower of Descartes, he was very much against this whole line of thinking. But the book is mostly about the people who took this idea seriously. Now, I do think, though, that if you do take this idea seriously, you do then go down the route of thinking, well, okay, what's going on here? And I think one thing that is common about people who engage in theodicy, at least in the old period, nowadays it's a much more restricted subject, but certainly in the old days, is the idea that you have to admit at the outset God is struggling with matter. God does not create the world, snap of the fingers. And that's an interesting point, right? Because when people start throwing around words like omnipotent, omnibenevolent, omniscient, you know, all these things that we always say God is, one has to keep in mind, well, look, if we're talking about the monotheistic gods of the Abrahamic religions, actually God does things in a very particular kind of way. And that particular kind of way needs to be registered in our understanding of God. And matter is always a problem for God. Right? Regardless of whether you believe that the world came into existence in 4.5 billion years or 6 days, why not like that? Okay? So in other words, you know, we have these disputes nowadays about whether we should be young earth creationists or not. You know, people who want to take a theistic line on science. But the more profound question is, why does it take any time at all? Okay? And it seems to me the people who were engaged in theodicy took that seriously. Right? That regardless of what the numbers are kind of something you can argue about. And see, here's where, you know, one of the points I've been trying to make on this blog, Uncommon Descent, about this point is that I think these people who engaged in theodicy took the Bible literally, but took it fallibly, but also corrigibly. In other words, they took the core stuff very literally. So when you see we're creating the image and likeness of God, they said, yes, that's true. But how many days, whatever, they're open-minded about that. But the point is, the fact that it takes any time at all is interesting, and that means that there's a struggle going on. Okay? And that is what the source of all the imperfections are. And then the question is, what do you make of that? And there were different views about this, and the different views have a lot to do with what is it that we, as the creature specifically created in the image and likeness of God, are in charge with doing to rectify this situation? Are we to do something to improve the situation? Right? In a sense, are we, as it were, to finish the job of creation? Which I think is, in fact, the way in which science, you know, the people who really promoted science as a result of this had that kind of attitude. Or are we to read this in a much more passive manner? Okay? And Leibniz talked about, well, you know, all this bad stuff gets put in so that we understand what the difference between good and bad is. That was Leibniz's view about the matter. And so Voltaire ridicules that. But there's another kind of view, which is the view that Malebranche took, which was that, in a sense, God requires us to get the job done. Because God is someone who does everything on principle. And when you do something on principle, when you create the world in a certain way, what you get are the laws of nature and stuff like that. But what you don't necessarily get is a guarantee that every creature that is governed by the laws of nature, are going to live well. And that's where our moral responsibility enters the picture. We have to decide what we do about that. Okay? Now, you might say, those of you listening to this might find this a very sort of abhorrent way of thinking about the relationship between science and religion. The one value that it does have is it's integrated. It's integrated. It takes the role of God operating in nature seriously. It takes the role of human beings seriously. And the long-term secular implication of this, because look, this sort of view, while it went off the map as far as a specific discipline is concerned, the ideas remained. And you know, we talk about this philosophy called utilitarianism, the greatest good for the greatest number. If you actually do the genealogy of that idea, and you go back to where it comes from, you will find William Paley, you will find Joseph Priestley, you will find all of these people invoking this kind of principle. And see, the greatest good for the greatest number principle, even in the secular world, only makes sense if it is possible for us to rationally adopt a system perspective, a systemic perspective toward whatever we're concerned about. Okay? And that is to say, can you adopt, in the case of nature, God's standpoint? And can you make some kind of judgment on the basis of that? And that's, in fact, how Darwin denied this. Darwin thought that the amount of suffering, the amount of death, the amount of destruction in nature was so much that you could not make this kind of prior assumption that there's some system-level basis on which you can talk about the good and the bad. Okay, and that is in fact where Darwin basically said theology has nothing to offer to the discussion. But what I am arguing for here is that we need to reintroduce this issue. Have I violated something here? No? I'm about to close, so maybe that's the right moment. But so the point here is that in the end, right, that if you really want to mount a serious challenge to Darwin, you need to actually reinvestigate, reintroduce the sort of stuff that in fact he got rid of by believing that the ideas of suffering and death and destruction were just so overwhelming that there is no possible way in which one could rationalize these processes as part of some sort of larger design in nature. Okay? And that's the challenge I really do think that people who want to defend intelligent design have. Namely, that one has to try to regain that system perspective that Darwin said was impossible to accomplish. And I'll stop there. First of all, I'm not exactly sure. I mean, I think what probably is true is that you don't have a lot of churchgoers among scientists, but being a churchgoer is not necessarily the only criteria you want to use to see whether people are committed to the kinds of beliefs that I'm talking about. I mean, because after all, even back in the 18th century, people like Joseph Priestley, these are very radical kind of guys, right? Even the people we call deists, I mean, it's interesting we call them deists. Right, so there's still God in there, right? I mean, what there isn't is a commitment to a church, okay? And my suspicion is that this is probably true today too, okay? That these are not church-going people, these scientists. And so you might say from a sociological standpoint, I would critique the kinds of surveys that are being used these days to try to figure out what exactly it is that scientists believe, okay? Because many of these surveys, to me, seem to be asking leading questions where basically, you know, if you're not a member of a church, you know, or you don't hold some very, you know, radical anti-scientific view, right, you're not religious in any kind of sense. But I actually am, I would be very surprised if people who devote their whole lives to science do not think that there is some kind of intelligent design out there. Otherwise, I just don't understand why they do it, unless they just say, well, I'm good at it. Or I'm just kind of curious, right? Because the project of science is a transgenerational project that aims to understand the nature of reality as such. It is a very profound thing, and most people, and everyone who engages in it is engaged in something that will not be fully realized in their lifetime. Okay, so what's the point of doing it? Right? I mean, I think that's always a question that needs to be asked. Okay, can you speak a little, I don't know, louder, slowly? I don't know.
Thank you for a very grandiloquent way of explaining the psychology as well as the desire of the scientist, which is by myself being one and living among them, our faith to either observe or feed. My question is actually two-pronged. What is an extension of that question? How do you explain pre-Christianity science or lack of science in the first 1,000 years of Christianity or science done by people who do not believe in monotheistic religion, despite being religious themselves?
Yeah.
The second point is, it seems that you have a solution to a problem, a biblical solution, which is a very fine solution, fits several models. And irrespective of what the other scientific belief is, you try to mold this biblical solution to fit, or you try to mold the problem to fit your biblical solution.
Okay, first of all, I do think this is where the Protestant Reformation makes a big difference here, okay? Because I think that you need a kind of anti-authoritarian movement within Christianity, which basically empowers people to read the Bible for themselves and to take their confrontation with the Bible as a personal decision, not just something that they are to believe because somebody who's smarter than them who reads a language they don't understand believes. Okay? So I think, you know, if you want to explain why it is that it takes so long for Christianity to actually be part of this progressive science movement, I mean, I say this as someone who's raised as a Catholic and went to Jesuit schools and all the rest of it, but I do think You know, the Protestant Reformation makes a big difference, and these guys in the Scientific Revolution, it's quite clear when you read the, you know, if you read the sort of the range of their writings, that they are reading the Bible and taking it personally, and that is a Protestant thing, it seems to me. Okay, and so there's that. That's how I would answer that question. Now, with regard to the second question, I'm not sure what you're getting at, but one thing I don't want people to come away with here is that if you in fact believe in a sort of biblically inspired notion of science, you will therefore be following the scientific orthodoxy. Right. In other words, this is why I think intelligent design theory is perfectly reasonable. Right. There's a sense in which if you take literally and seriously the kinds of issues that the Bible inspires you to do, and you factor that into your scientific research, you will disagree, I think, quite substantially with the orthodox scientific community. And there's nothing wrong with that. And that is an argument that continues to be had and needs to be had. And in this respect, this is where I kind of, in a way, distinguish myself from what I take to be what a lot of so-called theistic evolutionists are up to. Because I see theistic evolutionists as operating with a kind of separate but equal doctrine with regard to religion and science. Right? In religion, you know, you believe the Bible, but whatever you believe about the Bible, it doesn't interfere with what the orthodox scientists are saying. And I just think that is totally screwy. That is wrong on both fronts. And I think people like Richard Dawkins, you know, who's willing to kind of tolerate theistic evolutionists, he's laughing to his friends in private. I don't see how this does anyone any good, to be perfectly honest. Right? I mean, it seems to me that the really honest positions are ones that try to come up with some kind of integrated solution. And one integrated solution is atheism. Okay? But if you're an atheist, I don't know why you continue doing science.
How do you explain the scientists, the pre-Christian era scientists?
The what?
How do you explain pre-Christian era scientists?
Like whom, for example?
Number zero for that matter. Astrophysics for that matter.
Well, I mean, I think a lot depends on what. I mean, there's an issue here about what the aspirations of the knowledge are, and I associate science not just with holding certain kinds of beliefs about particular aspects of reality, but the whole striving to come up with an ever more comprehensive understanding of reality, and that having a kind of longevity to it. Okay? I mean, I actually think, for what it's worth, I think that our secular understanding of the history of science as this sort of ever progressive kind of thing, coming up with a greater and greater understanding of reality, is a secular version of a Christian salvation story. That is what it is. Okay? I mean, and you don't see that kind of narrative in other cultures, right? Because what we have to talk about here is not just whether certain cultures get certain beliefs right, but rather whether there is a sustained inquiry that is at the same time self-critical and progressive. And what motivates that? That's a very difficult thing, I think, to kind of push forward. You disagree? I mean, I think that's not obvious. That's not an easy thing to push.
More questions?
Right.
Although evil exists, that plan will eventually prevail.
That's right.
And therefore, is it much better to focus on theology, specifically with regard to God's goodness and his good plan, rather than theology, if we believe that we find it better?
But the question was, why did the speaker particularly focus on the question of theodicy rather than theology more generally?
Well, because I think there's a sense in which where we are at the moment in the argument is is where, if you look at the people who are opposed to any kind of theological understanding of things, and the easiest way in which you want to dismiss a design argument is to point to imperfection and to point to how things don't really work as planned. And the thing about theodicy that's very profound is the people who were involved in that argument from the very beginning realized that point, right? In other words, if you want to talk about design, you don't start just by talking about perfection. You start by realizing the imperfections and then trying to make some sense of that. So in a sense, the people involved in theodicy are already there with the Darwinists, right? They already see that nature is not perfect. Okay. Now, Darwin thought it was just so imperfect that you just couldn't believe in this stuff anymore. Okay. But the theodicists acknowledge the point. And I think that's where the strong point is. Because if you, you know, so they say, yes, there's all this, there's all this imperfection. There's all this evil. Now we have to somehow figure out what to make of that. And I think that is a very good starting point for the kind of world we live in now. Right, where the argument against design is primarily pitched at that level, namely, look, there is no design. Right, people, you know, I mean, you start by saying, look at all the imperfection in nature, and that provides a kind of prima facie grounds for thinking things weren't brought about by design. Excuse me. Oh, well, that the design will be realized in nature? Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Yes. Maybe that's true.
Last question.
Oh, just to say...
That's why I like Priestley. Okay.
What do you say to the guy who says, I'm a scientist, and my motivation for being a scientist, I'm prepared to give my life to science, is that it brings so much benefit to mankind? And I've seen that... how the world has changed to the benefit of mankind, and so I wish to give my life to science.
But it's an open verdict, isn't it? I mean, if you really take that literally, as it stands now, it's an open verdict. I mean, that's why you have to believe that it'll be better in the future, because I think at the moment, there's been a lot of destruction done in the name of science. Okay? And even when religious people do it, they need science. Okay, so I mean, I think it really does still involve faith in science. I don't think it's so obvious just on the ground.
No, it's not proven.
Yeah, exactly. I think faith is still required.
Before I finish off, if I can just mention next week's lecture. If I heard correctly, Steve has been telling us that Darwin. Darwin killed theodicy, which I have taken him to mean an attempt to make theological sense of this imperfect world. And I think Steve is saying that Darwin, he said he killed it. Next week we're going to test that idea, because our subject next week is Darwin and God. And our speaker next week will be Professor John Henry Brooke, a former professor here in Oxford of Science and Religion. And he is primarily a historian, and he will be taking us back into Darwin's own work and what Darwin said about God. And so we'll, I think, be testing whether he killed or whether he just ignored it.
That's nice.
I'm sure that you want to talk to Steve more, and please, if you've got your questions and points, come across to the senior common room just across the corridor to continue the discussion. Thank you all for coming. Hope to see you next week and in subsequent weeks. Can I ask a few Regents people?